Community Matters, solutions to local issues and leaders who are making a positive difference.
Hey, it's Megan from The Morning Show with another edition of Community Matters. This week, we are continuing our coverage on coronavirus responses around the community and organizations that are serving our community. And first up, we're talking to Paul Gianfrido. He is the president and CEO of Mental Health America, talking specifically about the mental health impact that coronavirus is having on our community and ways that we can help ourselves and each other. So without further ado, here's the interview with Paul Gianfrido.
I would love to just kind of get background from you. You are with Mental Health America, president and CEO of Mental Health America. So just based on where you're coming from, the work that you do, how different are the times that we're living in right now?
These times are completely different. I mean, we've all gone from a very stable economy and working in our offices with a work family to having total disruption in our lives, worried about who's going to survive and who's not going to survive, being totally isolated from the people that we spent most of our time with, and for many of us being isolated from members of our extended families as well.
And what kind of toll does that isolation, what can that take on our mental health?
Isolation can take a big toll on our mental health. One reason is because when you're sitting there and by yourself, there's no one to talk to. There's no one to give you feedback. And you can start dwelling on your own thoughts. And it's perfectly natural at a time like this to be worried. So we know everybody is living with a certain amount of worry. But when that worry begins to be unaddressed, it can transform into anxiety, and then from anxiety to severe anxiety. And that's a clinical condition that needs treatment.
And are there things that we can be sort of on the lookout for to kind of see when things, when our own feelings or own emotions are kind of crossing that line into something that we need to start seeking treatment for?
Yeah, you know, our gut usually tells us that this feels different from the way this may have felt yesterday or the way this may have felt last week. And what I try to tell people is that when your gut's feeling that things are a little different, don't guess at that point. Just go take a mental health screen. We offer them free of charge at mhascreening.org, where people can screen anonymously. And the anxiety screen we use, the depression screen we use, they're the same ones that clinicians use in their office. So go take a mental health screen anonymously, see what results you get. And that way you don't have to guess about whether or not that worry is transforming too far to anxiety or depression or something else, but you'll know.
In regards to Mental Health America, I do see that there's some online tools available. Can you tell us about that through the Mental Health America website?
Yeah, 2,000 to 3,000 people a day come to our website to take a mental health screen. So we have a whole set of screening resources available on our website. We also have a really well-developed page of COVID-19 resources specifically for people, all related to all aspects of mental health with connections to partners and others as well. And finally, we have our new Mental Health Month toolkits out. And not only does the Mental Health Month toolkit for this May give general tips for how to maintain your own mental health, there's some very specific, very easy to understand information about what COVID-19 may be doing as well to influence mental health. So there are at least three things that people can get at mhanational.org that they should take advantage of, all of which are available fully and free of charge.
I love that. I think that that's incredible. And I think it's a resource that a lot of our community is completely unaware of and definitely could take advantage of. I think that that's fantastic. So thank you. Just from a member of the public, thank you for offering that to our people. How are you feeling just about, I guess, like the temper of the community? Are you feeling like things are getting really tense? Do you feel like things are finding any sort of settling feeling? Do you feel like people are kind of finding a rhythm, finding a groove, or do you feel like things are kind of ramping up a little bit?
I think on the behavioral health side, things are still ramping up some. It's relentless. You know, the news comes at us relentlessly, the numbers come at us relentlessly, and they're going to continue to do that for a while. We think that the mental health concerns increased almost at the same time the physical health concerns and the physical health numbers began to get bigger too. So as long as those numbers keep getting bigger, I think we're going to have issues and concerns. My concern, though, is that if we don't address the mental health side of this, long after the physical health symptoms have abated, long after we've put COVID-19 behind us, and we will put it behind us. We will still have leftover trauma. We'll still have leftover stress that won't have been dealt with. And if those things aren't dealt with, the next trigger could make things even worse for people. So we can't just ignore these mental health issues and think they're going to go away when the physical risk goes away. In fact, they're planting seeds in us right now. We need to deal with that and take care of that before things grow to something worse.
That's really worth talking about, because I don't think that even my brain has gone to what's going to be the recovery effort in our own brains and in our own hearts from the situation. Because I think I'm just taking everything one day at a time. But you bring up a valid point. What are we looking at in terms of once we get past this? What sort of trauma are we still going to be dealing with even after we're past the worst?
Yeah, it could be dramatic. I mean, if we've seen, and we have, a 10 to 20% increase in the number of people taking a screen and in the screening results that they're getting in terms of the severity of the results, and you broaden that to the entire population, let's just say we had a 10 to 20% increase in the need for behavioral health treatment services. If we don't get a handle on this, that's a $25 billion price tag that our country will be paying over the course of the next year or two. And in addition to that, we're going to have a lot of bad outcomes. And so, you know, we can't, too often, because we're in a crisis mode and crisis mentality, we're concerned about the threat, the physical threat. But we need to understand that when in crisis mode, our mental health has an equal threat that is being made to it. And in the results can be really bad, really poor, and really dramatic if we don't recognize that.
What are some things that we can do just every day to kind of keep those worries, keep our anxiety levels low? Are there physical activities that we can engage in that can help?
Yeah. First of all, keep control of the things you can. Sort of figure out, what is it that I can control? I can control when I get up in the morning, at least. I can control when I go to bed at night, at least. And then add to that the same kind of things that we do for maintaining mental health. If you can get out and take a walk around a neighborhood, around a community, around your backyard, just around your house or apartment, if that's all you've got, just that physical activity does really help as well. And then I think people can also do the kinds of things that have always brought them comfort and relaxation. I think a lot of times at a time like this, people try to invent new ways to relax, because somebody says, well, take up painting or learn a new language. And, you know, for some people who don't do those things and haven't done those things, that's just more stressful. But everybody has used things of their own. I play an accordion. I play my accordion to relax. That's what I do.
Do you really?
Not what everybody should do. That's right. And so people should do those things, you know, take advantage of those things that help us, you know, center ourselves and ground ourselves and just feel a little more comfortable in the moment. Make the best of each moment and continue to look forward. You know, if not a week down the road or 6 weeks down the road when things may still be bad, look 6 months down the road. And when you know things are going to be a little better, and make some plans for 6 months down the road, whether or not you ultimately do those things, at least the idea that the process of planning is in itself helping you to look forward and helping you to get out of the most uncomfortable moments.
Well, I'm looking forward to a few months down the road, maybe even sooner, when we have Paul Gianfrido, president and CEO of Mental Health America, doing accordion lessons on YouTube. I think that that's something that we should probably have happen. You're the first accordion player I've ever spoken with.
Well, how about that? I'm not surprised by that, but yes, I think if we get to the stage where people are looking for Paul Gianfrido to be playing accordion on YouTube, then we'll have a lot of other conversations at that point between now and then. So
you bring up a good point about do things that bring you less stress. Like if you hear of other people, I mean, who was it? Like Shakespeare wrote something and Isaac Newton came up with something when they were in some sort of self-isolation period, but we shouldn't put those expectations on ourselves. And so I wanted to ask you, from the social media standpoint, right now, we have a lot of friends spending so much time on Facebook and so much time on Instagram, and they're seeing other people in their circle of friends who are doing all of these amazing things. Can you talk about the mental health impacts on ourselves if we allow those things to put added pressures on us?
Yeah, you know, we've seen that from, you know, since social media becomes so popular that people see the best of somebody else on social media and then think the worst of themselves because they feel they can't compare. In this instance, though, you know, it might be helpful to people to know that if a friend is in a position to put a nice picture up or to show something happy, to be able to just feel that is not such a bad thing. But to think that is the only way that person is living would be a mistake. And in fact, what I think is really important for all of us to recognize is that even those people, and maybe especially those people who look overly happy on social media, they may be feeling overly sad on any given day. So it's a good time to just remember that just as you want people to reach out to you, it's an opportunity for you to reach out to them. So maybe when somebody posts something, it's not a bad idea to put in the comments, how are you doing? And see what kind of an honest answer you might get back. You might be surprised.
That's really good. Kind of not calling somebody out for their smoke screen, but being aware that that could be what it is. It's just, you know, putting up something to prevent somebody from seeing what's really going on behind all that.
Yeah, a lot of us are afraid to show those feelings. We've been brought up to be afraid to show when we're in need of help. And sometimes it just, all it takes is somebody else reaching out and asking the question for people to begin to open up. And I do know that when I tell my stories, you know, my personal stories, my family stories, it always invites other people to open up and tell their stories as well. So it's a good use of social media to try to get those more balanced stories out and to gain support and give support from your friends.
That's great. Right now, as we do have so many people in isolation, my heart goes out to those who live their lives that way. They're already in a constant state of isolation. The shut-ins, the people who, for health reasons or for mental reasons, don't seek out the company of others. Are there ways that we can connect to help keep the mental health impacts of on those particular people within the population, keep those at bay? Are there things that we can do to help reach out to those who are even more isolated than usual?
But the problem, of course, is that we can't go knock at the door and visit with them for a while. So what do we do then? Well, we all do have, you know, technology that's available to today that wasn't available 20 years ago, 10 years ago, or 5 years ago. So helping somebody figure out for the very first time on their smartphone how to do a video call is something that we can do in order to video call with people. For those who have been, we've been used to just texting and, you know, it's a good opportunity to pick up the phone and use the audio feature to just have somebody hear a voice and to be able to connect that way. These are times to use the tools that may not have always gotten the best reputations, but they're tools that are available to us to try to help more people become connected and even to build circles of friends around those people. So maybe somebody would say, well, I'm concerned my neighbor is isolated, but I don't really know how to reach out directly to them. Well, if you know how to reach out to their family member to ask them, that's something you can do. So you can think about your expanded circles of friends. And I don't know about other people, but I'm hearing from a lot of people I haven't heard from in years, just because of the fear that everybody's got, just trying to check in and make sure people are okay. And so it's not a big deal right now. It doesn't seem unusual and doesn't seem too forward to be checking in and asking if people are okay.
Well, Paul, thank you. I know that our time is getting short. I would just love for you to repeat one more time just the website for MHA and just the resources that people can access there, just so that they leave with that final piece of information in their ears.
So our website is mhanational.org. We have a COVID-19 resource page on there. We also have a link to our screening site, which you can also go directly to at mhscreening.org to take a mental health screen when you need it. And we also have a link to our Mental Health Month materials, which also provide additional COVID-19 resources, as well as additional mental health resources available to people. We have a goal of 1 million in May, having 1 million more screenings done in May. We've had 5 million done to date. We'd like to get 1 million more because we want people to take care of themselves and to know what it is they need to do in order to have the tools and resources to accomplish that. So thanks.
Excellent. Paul Gianfrido, thank you for your time. I appreciate the work that you do, and I wish you the best in all of your accordion playing ventures today.
Thank you very much.
There you have it. Resources and information on mental health impacts from coronavirus and what we can do to help ourselves and each other. Now we are turning our attention to schools, and we're going to be talking to Ray Saldana, who is the CEO of Communities in Schools. And this is an organization that works with schools, not just in the state of Virginia, but around the country, helping to provide resources to those students, specifically those most at need. So good morning, Ray Saldana. Thank you so much for joining us. Could you start off by telling us a little bit about what Communities in Schools does during a normal school time, not necessarily factoring what's going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So in normal circumstances, we are actually not, the concept of dealing with students who are in crisis is not foreign to us. We work within schools, as our title indicates, in many cases, working with the most vulnerable students in that any school population. So those students who come to us because of poor attendance, whether they're court-involved youth or have academic issues, they are case managed by a site coordinator, which is the term we use for the individuals that we have that have been trained and have been placed in those schools specifically, who work on ensuring that any barrier that that student has towards success, whether it be access to food, access to a healthcare professional, or just academic supports, those are integrated into the case studies or into the caseworkers, into the case that students are going through. Throughout the year. So pre-COVID, we were working with students who were already, in many cases, on the margins, concerned about attending school and being safe in school. So that's the work we do all across the state of Virginia. And it's really been a real lift to try to adapt and pivot to this work as well, now that we're in really rougher waters.
So that does kind of lead then to my next question. The services that you provide, the work that you do, it really does hinge upon the doors of the school being open. So how are you adapting and how are you serving the communities that you typically serve during this time when they don't have access to those resources that they usually do?
Sure. Great question. And this is such a significant one that not just Communities in Schools, but other sort of national nonprofits who are working with the most vulnerable, because for us, it is true, Communities in Schools works in schools. So what the question is, what happens when the safest place for that student, the place where we interact with them, is shut down? And so we are quickly finding ourselves adapting to the most immediate needs that we know students have. In many cases, those are access to supplies that they need. We deal with students who certainly live with food insecurity, so we're trying to make contact with those family members. And in many cases, that means knocking on doors and leaving food supplies right outside the door. And for the state of Virginia, there's 47,000 students we serve. Again, we have done the work of placing ourselves in those schools and in those communities that need us the most. So it really just means that the gaps that existed pre-COVID now are just amplified. And we're trying to certainly triage as an EMT would to bandage the wound, but we try to think long-term, the loss of learning, the loss of connection with a caring adult face-to-face, which we're going to try to prepare for when these students ultimately come back to schools.
Now, if you've lived in Virginia for any length of time, you can probably agree that it feels like there's different Virginias within Virginia. The way that the state is structured such that students and families that live in the Northern Virginia area, the access that they have to even technology and internet access is vastly different from other parts of the state. And so could you speak a little bit to Virginia as a whole, the prevalence of like that digital divide that we've heard about where families do struggle with access to internet across the state?
Sure, absolutely. And what we are seeing on the ground is really more stark than we probably would like to admit with regard to students who will just completely lose access. And again, we work with the students who we know are the most vulnerable. So it isn't even just a distinction between rural and urban. It really is a question that is tied down to one's income. And so the cases of individual stories that we have heard of our site coordinators going out to try to by cell phones at the very least. That's how bare the access is, just so that they can create a cell connection. And we're not yet even talking about Wi-Fi. It really puts us in the position to try to think about what we used to believe was a nice to have for these communities, which it would be nice that every student had a laptop and connection to internet. That was the standard protocol previous to the pandemic. I think you're going to walk into a new world where many school districts are making decisions, and we hope, specifically with regard to the work that we do to connect with students, that allows us to connect with them, not just during moments of crisis, but even in times of the summer that we know students dip and slide. So the connection to broadband, the connection to internet is so significant when we talk about the gaps in equity for the students that we're trying to serve, if we really truly care about serving the most vulnerable or highest need.
I was talking to a teacher friend literally just yesterday who lives in my neighborhood, and even in the area where we are, she's having trouble serving her students because each of her students has such different access to food, to technology, to everything. And so one of her concerns as a teacher was, how do I serve those who have the access and leave behind those who don't? Is there anything that we as communities can do to rally around the families who need the most help?
Sure. I would say that there are two things. One of them that we can manage at the local level, because every one of us lives within a school district, and us and our school districts have school board leadership. Many of them, again, have approached the question of tech and access to Wi-Fi and internet as something that we would like to do in good times when the, you know, finances work out, so that we can provide that for our school districts. That's where we have a level of advocacy to play. And for our organization, what we know is that we have tried to connect many of the students that we serve, again, the most vulnerable, through some of the emergency funds that we have in Virginia. But some of those have been depleted, trying to triage the most important concerns, like making sure that children have food in their bellies. So I think what we've tried to do is direct folks to our website, where our local Virginia affiliate is buying Wi-Fi hotspots in the interim to ensure that students have access to the bare bones, which is an equitable chance to the educational tools that are being offered in their local school district. So we've asked folks to try to visit us at communitiesandschools.org to hear more about how we're trying to create a fund specific to the pandemic and ways that we could triage students' immediate needs. But long term, I think it makes sense that we are looking at school districts as making decisions that are about a world outside of the pandemic that includes every student's ability to learn at an equitable level.
And then just looking to the other side of this pandemic, when schools are reopened, what do you think the change that we're going to see is, considering we've had such a length of time without access to the typical resources? Do you think that there's anything that communities and schools is going to be doing differently when the doors are eventually reopened?
Yeah, absolutely. So specific to Virginia, and we have been piloting the concept of how we evaluate social emotional health of a student. And in many cases, when we don't get that piece right, it manifests itself in other ways around anxiety or depression or anger. And I think what we're going to need, if students haven't been in a schoolroom, haven't been at school for 3 or 4 months, is a real ability to evaluate that. And communities and schools is looking to not sort of contract at a moment where we're needed most now. We're going to double down in this work, especially at the elementary school and middle school level. And in that respect, I think communities and schools specifically knows that there's going to be so much to unpack, especially because when we say that schools are the safest place for our students, that is particularly true with students who we know deal with things in the home that you know, whether it's violence or exposure to addiction or family members that have been incarcerated, there's trauma exposure already. We're now dealing with a new level of that for some of the students that we case manage, that we want to ensure to remove barriers to their future success.
Well, Ray Saldana, I want to thank you for your time today. I know that you've got a line of interviews right after this, I'm going to let you go, but I did just want to thank you. I appreciate the work that you're doing to serve the kids across the state, and just especially during this time when things are so crazy and so difficult. Thank you for continuing to fight for those kids and for those families.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you for taking the call.
There you have it. Another edition of Community Matters right here on Your Encouraging WPER. As always, you can listen to these back again right on our website, WPER.org. We'll have information there about each week's interviews, and you can listen back and get any information that you may have missed or just want to hear again. And we hope you join us next week right here again on Community Matters.